You know who we should get on the show? The author of the Seven Deadly Sins of Apologetics. Now? We're on the air? Okay. Hello, and welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. We continue now with Open Forum. Mark Brumley, president of Ignatius Press, and the author of the Seven Deadly Sins of Apologetics, is here to take your questions. Hello, Mark Brumley.
Hello, Cy. You know, there weren't seven deadly sins until I authored them.
Now there are seven deadly
now
sins.
There are.
No, that is not true. This was a work of observation, not invention, because everything that happens that you say that you could do wrong, I've heard people do those things wrong. I probably have done six of the seven myself.
Really? Six? Wow.
I'm just giving myself a good grade.
Seven.
I was trying to give myself a good grade. I was grading on the curve right there. 888-318-7884 is our number. Anybody can call with any question at all about the Catholic faith. Mark Brumley, as president of Ignatius Press, as a longtime Catholic theologian and minister, he's here to answer your question, whether you're Catholic or not. 888-318-7884. You got anything new at Catholic Answers? At Ignatius Press that we should know about? Like, the hot new product is a new book from, or anything like that, or?
Well, a bunch of things to say. First, you should also introduce me as a former Catholic Answers staffer, because
I should, yeah.
Really, that's really where it all started, you know, my life. My marriage to my wife, and then being a Catholic Answers staffer, so those are the two things, right?
And when you were here, like, along with yourself, who,
yes.
and of course, Carl Keating, who were the big dogs here when you were here? I think I think it was Pat Madrid.
Pat Madrid and Charlie Harvey and Carrie Rusnowski. She was the secretary. I don't remember Carrie's maiden name. That's her married name. And me, that was it. We did everything. So
that's pretty good.
It's exciting.
Yeah, thanks for doing it, by the way. I love working here. Thanks for building this apostolate.
Thank Carl.
Well, I have thanked Carl.
I marginally contributed, and Pat, of course, contributed too. I mean, obviously. So that's the Catholic Answers, former Catholic Answers staffer thing. And I have my Catholic Answers staffer T-shirt from one of the Catholic Answers conferences, which I wear proudly. So that's what's going on there. New on Ignatius Press. Well, lots of new books are coming out. But I want to talk about something we're doing this month, which is people should go to ipnovels.com, because we're having a big push on reading novels for the summer.
Great.
We have kinds of special deals on novels. And we think that, you know, Catholic fiction is something we're seeing a resurgence of. We don't have enough people reading the novels. And you say, well, you say that as a book publisher. And of course, obviously, we are a book publisher. But I say that as someone who has a common good interest in the life and mission of the church. I think novels are part of the evangelizing mission of the church. And I base that conclusion on the fact that Jesus himself, though he didn't write novels, he told stories. And so storytelling is an important part of evangelization. And in fact, there's a certain sense in which we can think of all of history as God's story.
Yeah.
So we want Catholics to form their imaginations as well as their intellects and wills with virtue. And one powerful way you can form your imagination is by reading good novels, not just Catholic novels. Okay. There are novels that are not explicitly Catholic. They're nonetheless good, but good Catholic novels, adds a dimension to it that is very important for Catholics to develop.
This sounds like we should do a Catholic Answers focus summer reading with Mark Brumley, and he should maybe give us like seven or eight novels that you can think about reading.
I'd be great. I'd be up for that.
Can we afford him for that? Do we have that in the budget? I mean, he's Mark Brumley. Maybe we can get a major donor to support that.
I was going to say, this would not be one of those situations where I have to pay you to be on the air like I usually do.
No, this time we would pay you. This would be a big turnaround.
Oh, my goodness. So ipnovels.com.
ipnovels.com. All right. And did Marie hear what I said? Is she going to schedule this with Mark? will you do it, Mark? I'm asking you on the air, so you can't say no.
I will do it, yes.
All right. Very good.
Yeah, lots of good stuff there. I mean, they're powerful stories.
Yes.
powerful novels, and you know, they're fun too. That's the other thing. You know, you talk about, oh, really, Catholic imagination. Oh, you know, it sounds like a kind of like a spiritual workout. But the thing is, the novels are moving, inspirational, fun, all that kind of stuff. So,
oh, I can't wait to hear what your recommendations are going to be.
I mean, yeah, I think did we talk? I mean, I posted a little bit about this on Facebook about some upcoming novels that we have for the fall, and I don't like. In a way, I don't like doing that because I don't want to be unfair to the novels we published thus far, which are really great. But I'm excited about these novels because they're a little bit off. Not all of our novels. We've got just ordinary Catholic novels. I don't want to give people the impression we only publish kind of offbeat stuff. But we have some offbeat stuff coming in the fall that I'm really excited about. One novel, which is called This Thing of Darkness, which is about Bela Lugosi. Who played Dracula. And then we have Providence Blue, which is about H.P. Lovecraft.
Wow, and, you got into the monsters there.
Robert Howard, who was the inventor of Conan the Barbarian. And it's going to sound bizarre to some people, but these actually are interesting stories in Catholic novels that have you know, I think a profound message, and they're just lots of fun too. So,
oh, that is great. All right, we got you scheduled now. You have to do it. Have to do this focus with us. Get people reading novels. Our number 888-318-7884. Mark Brumley, our guest. About a million people on the line. Mark, shall we go to the phones?
Let us do that.
All right, Chet in Houston, Texas, watching on Catholic.com. Excuse me, I beg your pardon, Chet. Go ahead with your question, Chet, for Mark Brumley.
Thank you. And Mark, thank you for your publications. I've bought several books over the years from your Ignatius. My question today is, you bet. My question is, how did a female enter the Old Covenant? Or the Mosaic Covenant. And I might have a follow-up question to your answer.
Well, I'll decide that. I'm in charge of that. No, I'm sorry. I got a little uppity with you. Sorry about that. Go ahead, Mark.
Don't feel too bad, Chet. He gets uppity with me, too.
I do with everybody.
He puts me in my place. Well, yeah, so how did the females enter? Well, I'll say everyone, our male, both men and women, entered the Old Covenant or the Mosaic Covenant by their adherence to the God of the Covenant, who is Yahweh, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God who established the covenant with the people of Israel on Mount Sinai. So it's through adherence to and allegiance to that God and identification or association with God's covenant people, the nation of Israel. Now, so there is so when it comes to adherence to Yahweh, the God of Israel, there's a dimension of faith, of commitment and fidelity to the covenant. I'm going to be true to what God has commanded. There is a dimension of participation in what we would call today the sacramental life, but we'll say worship, following the prescriptions of the Mosaic Law that had to do with divine worship. And then, of course, there is obedience to the moral dimension of the Mosaic Law. All these are a woman, pledges herself to these things. Now, ordinarily, you say, but how does that happen concretely, specifically? And ordinarily, we think of entering into the Mosaic Covenant for men as being bound up with the sign of circumcision. And it's true that circumcision was a sign of that covenant, although it pre-existed the Mosaic Covenant. We know that from the fact that Abraham was circumcised, and Abraham had his people circumcised. So it predates that, but it is a sign that's associated with the Mosaic Covenant. And so we often think of, well, women, how did they do it? They weren't circumcised. So how did they, what was the sign of covenant for them? And usually it's said to be their association, identification with the man in some way. So daughters were associated with the covenant through their fathers. Wives were associated with the covenant, entered into the covenant through their marriage to their husbands. And so on that, so those are often – the ways, or that is often the way in which it's said or thought that women concretely, specifically, tangibly became identified with the covenant. I don't want to emphasize that point too much because I think it is correct to say in the very patriarchal form of the covenant, and I'm not using that word pejoratively, I'm using it descriptively, the patriarchal structure of Old Testament covenant life, there was an association, obviously, with father figures or men and so on. But for women, it was, and then, as I say, you know, circumcision was that sign. But it was true that you really didn't participate in the covenant. Even if you were circumcised, you did not participate in the covenant. If you did not believe in the God of Israel, you did not participate in the worship of Israel, and you didn't obey the moral law. You might be covenantally signed, circumcised if you were a man, but that sign pointed to these other realities, these other aspects of believing and worship and obeying. And so that was really what was at the heart of the of fidelity or participation in the Old Covenant for men, and it's what was at the heart of participation and fidelity to the covenant for women.
Chet, go ahead and make your case for being allowed a follow-up. Do you feel that I should allow that?
Well, I thought the circumcision was more than symbolic, was my assumption. I think the Gentiles were required to be circumcised prior to Christ to enter into the Old Covenant.
That's right. But when we say more than symbolic, you have to be careful. Circumcision is a pledge or a sign or an act of commitment. So it's true, it has a symbolic dimension to it, but it's not as if it's just simply represented an association with the covenant or an association with the God of the covenant. No, it was actually an act of obedience to and commitment to the God of the covenant, and therefore an act of covenantal fidelity.
And we're going to have to leave it there because we're actually a little bit late for the break. So we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more. Mark Brumley on Catholic Answers Live, open forum.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
He was a pope, a saint, and a doctor of the church.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
Pope St. Gregory I the Great is one of only four popes honored as the Great. Among his many achievements was sending missionaries across Northern Europe, especially St. Augustine of Canterbury, who brought Christ to the people of England. In a pun, Pope Gregory called the English people angels. He died in 604.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and our guest is Mark Brumley this hour, the president of Ignatius Press, the most important publishing house in the Alpha Quadrant. Right now, we have a free ebook for you, and I haven't mentioned this in a while, so I want to again, The Real Story of the Crusades and the Inquisition. These are two sticking points, and there's reasons why these are sticking points. Many people will, in a certain sense, throw this in the face of a Catholic and say, what about the Crusades and the Inquisition? Well, there are answers to those questions. Get your copy today at shop.catholic.com. Look for the button at the top of the page. It's free, a free ebook, The Real Story of the Crusades and the Inquisition at shop.catholic.com. Mark Brumley, it's just full lines. So I say we just keep going back to calls.
Very good. Sounds great.
All right. We'll go to Cincinnati, Ohio. Listening on 740 a.m. in Cincinnati is Julian. Julian, go ahead with your question for Mark Brumley.
So my question is, there are several passages of scriptures across the Gospels where Jesus said that he was Lord of the Sabbath. In Exodus chapter 20, verses 8 to 11, it says the Sabbath is the Sabbath of the Lord. Doesn't that make the Sabbath the Lord's day instead of Sunday?
interesting question. Of course, we have to understand what's the relationship between God's purpose in creation and the fall, and God's purpose in redemption and glorification, to be able to answer that question. The Sabbath, Saturday, the seventh day of the week, in the Genesis account of creation, has the Sabbath being at the end of creation. God creates the world, and there's the Sabbath day. And that Sabbath day is the day of God's rest. Well, if we take that literally, then we say God must be the kind of being that gets tired out because he had to rest. That's not the meaning of the Sabbath. The meaning of God's rest is he is taking delight in, he is appreciating the goodness that he has endowed the creation, he has endowed created being with. And so that's the purpose of this. So we as God's creatures need to rest, refrain from our ordinary non-sabbatical activities to acknowledge the goodness of creation, that creation comes from God, and to gift it back to God by not treating our activities on the Sabbath as if they were this world concerned, but rather direct our activities to God. That's the meaning of the Sabbath. But man fell. So we go from Genesis 1 to Genesis 2 through down to Genesis 3. Man fell and marred the created order and distorted creation. And so the Sabbath then comes to signify man's need for redemption and the fact that God redeems. And so Israel goes into bondage into Egypt, and that's a mark of the effects of sin, partly Israel's sin, but partly human sin more generally. God calls Israel out of Egypt, redeems Israel through passing through the Red Sea. And so the Sabbath comes to take on the meaning of redemption as well as creation. Okay. But that redemption, like the original creation, is incomplete and inadequate. The complete creation is the new creation when God unites man to himself in such a way that man comes to participate in God's own life, that we become sons, gender-inclusive sense, in the Son, Jesus Christ himself, and we participate in the divine life of the Trinity through the Son. That's the ultimate creation, the new creation, where God creates us as participants in his divine nature. But because redemption is not complete with respect to the old covenant and the Exodus and the Mosaic law, but is brought to completion through Jesus Christ, there is a further redemption. And that happens on Good Friday, on the Passion of Christ on the cross. And the beginning of the new creation, the redemption of human nature, occurs and is manifest in the resurrection on Easter Sunday. So we go from the sign of God's creation and man's need for redemption and God's initial redemption for the Sabbath, the seventh day, the last day of the week, under the old order, to the new Sabbath, the new creation, which is inaugurated on the eighth day, Sunday, which is both the eighth day of the old week, the old creation, and the first day of the new creation that is to come. So Christians live in this period of the new Sabbath, where we're not observing the Sabbath under the old creation, which points to the original creation and to man's sin, but we're living under the new Sabbath, first day of the week, the day of Christ's resurrection, when the early Christian communities gathered, celebrated the Eucharist, which is a sign of Christ's redemption and the redemption to come, the second coming. Christians celebrate the new Sabbath. So the meaning of the old Sabbath is transformed by Jesus Christ himself, who rose from the dead on the third day, which is also the eighth day and the first day of the new creation. And that's why we do, in that sense, observe the Sabbath. It's the Sabbath of the new order, the new creation, and the fullness of the redemption of human nature, its transformation, glorification in Christ.
Julian, I'm going to leave it there only because our lines are very, very full, and I want to get to as many as I can with Mark Brumley, our guest. I hope that that was helpful to you. We're going now to Maryland. Liam in Maryland, watching on YouTube Live. You are up next, Liam. Go ahead with your question for Mark Brumley.
Thank you for taking my call. I want to say first and foremost that, of course, I submit to God and His church and teachings. I have a question about one of them, though. In the Catechism, it says that the purpose of sex is for the unity between man and woman and the pleasure and intimacy in that, and then for procreation. And my question is that I don't think that many people go into the sexual act for the purpose of procreation. And in fact, there are quite a lot of ways to prevent conception, including some approved by the Catholic Church, such as natural family planning. And the question is, well, if isn't man's purpose to, or, you know, human purpose to go into sex, to procreate, it is God's, and if it's God's, then how is any way of interrupting that natural process of conception, whether by a bit of plastic in a condom or by a timing schedule, how is that different?
Wow. Okay, that's a lot, Liam. You, go ahead, Mark.
Well, of course, there are two purposes of God-given purposes inherent in the sexual conjugal act. I mean, it's just what it does when you engage in sexual intercourse. That's built into it. If I'm understanding the question correctly, Liam, you're saying that people don't engage in sexual relations for the purpose of procreation, that they do it for the unitive purpose only? Is that part of your question?
Yes, sir. I speak for, basically a personal experience and frankly, if so procreation was in my mind at all, I certainly hope it doesn't happen. That was when I was living in sin before I was a Catholic.
Right.
But like it seems like that.
But you don't think, Liam, that married couples, for example, know that what they're engaging in will produce children and will that?
I think they know that it's a possibility, if you will, a hazard, and that's why there are so many precautions to prevent it. Some people, many people, want children, but they certainly want to moderate the process to, two or three instead of conceiving more regularly.
Oh, you should come around here to Catholic Answers sometime.
I was going to say, some people, want children, and so they engage in marital relations because they want children, and that's how you have children. Now, do some of the people who want children and engage in sexual relations in order to have children want to moderate how many children they have? Sure. But that's not at odds with the desire to have children, to have children in a way in which you are generous, but nevertheless, taking into consideration your circumstances and who you are, there's nothing inappropriate about that or anything contrary to the procreative meaning of sexual relations any more than the fact that I need to be, if I'm susceptible to, if I have an allergy to a certain kind of food, to be mindful of my allergic condition and therefore to regulate how I eat or what I eat, or if I'm dealing with issues of weight and I'm overweight or I'm underweight, being mindful of how much or how little I'm eating isn't at odds with the nutritional significance of eating. So I hope I'm not being dense here, but I'm not seeing how it's a problem that would somehow be contrary to the procreative meaning of sexual relations for a couple to take into consideration things like do we think this is a good time to have children, and if they reasonably judge otherwise, for them to avoid marital relations during times when they think it's likely that they're going to procreate. There are two meanings, not just one, and the meanings are meanings that should not be set at odds with one another. I could pursue with my wife the unitive meaning of sexual relations without pursuing the procreate meaning, so long as I have a good reason to not pursue the procreative meaning at this moment, and I don't actively or positively undermine or attack that meaning, and simply choosing to have relations during an infertile time for a good reason isn't changing the nature of the act or isn't attacking procreation as if it were a bad thing. I'm just simply pursuing some other good for the time being, with the understanding that later I will be open to the procreative meaning. But anyway, that I'm not following the burden of the question, I think.
Liam, thanks. We got to take a break. You can hear the music. Mark Brumley is our guest. It's open forum. Lines continue to be full, so we'll be right back with more answers from Mark Brumley on Catholic Answers Live, open forum.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
Bishop Joseph Strickland of Tyler, Texas, is one of the most courageous leaders in the church, known for his outspoken support of unborn life, Orthodox faith and morals, and reforming Catholic institutions. In his groundbreaking new book, Light and Leaven, he offers a forthright perspective on the state of the church today and calls on the lay faithful to meet its challenges boldly. Touching on topics including parish renewal, the centrality of the Eucharist, the need for prayer and silence in a noisy and distracted age, and the battle between good and evil in the church and world, Bishop Strickland's wise insights and evident love for souls will inspire and edify you. To order your copy of Light and Leaven, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
To many people, even many Christians, purgatory is a fantasy, or worse, a wicked lie invented by the church to make salvation complicated and keep people in fear. But I'm here to tell you that purgatory is fact, not fiction. The Bible supports it, Christians have historically believed in it, and it makes theological sense. In my new book, Purgatory is for Real, I provide the evidence and reasoning to help you understand this controversial doctrine and demonstrate how it's actually a joyful, hopeful reality, not something shadowy and mysterious, but a sign of God's love and mercy. To get your copy of Purgatory is for Real, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Oh, yeah. You get the thumbs up for that, Darren. Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host. A little bit taken aback. Just a little bit. Not offended or anything. I don't want anybody to think I'm offended. But it really is striking to me, Mark, from the previous conversation we just had with a very fine and you know, interesting caller, this not seeming to know that for most of human history, in most situations, people celebrated having babies, especially married people were happy to have babies. And that it seems very modern affliction that we don't think about babies that way anymore. Like that's a real sadness that we don't think about babies like that anymore.
Right. During the break, we're talking about how, you know, let's take it out of our culture and look at other cultures where it's still the case that, you know, people that have healthy attitudes towards babies want to have babies. So then
Right. Husbands
and wives having marital relations don't say, oh, well, gee, maybe we're going to have a baby. Ooh, that'd be scary. I mean, there are situations where that can be the case. But most couples are, you know, if they're ready to get married, they're, you know, they may be looking to have babies. They may be, you know, spacing them or all kinds of things like that. But they don't have this deep hostility or aversion to having babies. And we were talking about in other cultures, that's certainly not the case.
No, right. In most of the cultures of the world that are not this hyper-modern techno-culture we live in, you think people get married wanting to have babies, like, and seeing each child that comes as a blessing. Not that they're not a hardship as well. I mean, I think everybody knows it's like a job. You want a job. It doesn't mean a job's like the easy, like jobs are hard, like,
right. But
people like the hard stuff in life.
Right.
People don't,
right.
It just seems like we modern people are stuck in that. Anyways, I don't know. It's funny.
But I mean, one point that we should make, I try to make this towards the end of the call, and that is that these two meanings complement one another, the unitive, that is the person uniting meaning, and the procreative, that is the person begetting meaning of sexual intercourse, which is tied to marriage, obviously. These things complement one another, and we can have good reasons for pursuing the procreative meaning, excuse me, the unitive meaning, the person uniting meaning, without at that very moment intending as well to procreate a child. There can be good reasons doing that, but the point is that we can't treat that good of procreation as if it were a bad thing, so that we're going to alter the meaning of the act. So we're going to use a contraceptive, whether it's a physical contraceptive or a chemical contraceptive. That's a problem, because there we're not just simply not choosing to pursue that meaning while pursuing the unit of meaning. We're actually choosing to positively thwart, attack, treat as an evil to be avoided, the procreative meaning. And that's a big difference between that and what happens in, say, natural family planning. Although some people, you can abuse natural family planning, but we don't want to, but simply, you know, spacing marital relations so that you can avoid pregnancy for a time or for certain circumstances and so on doesn't change the procreative meaning of the act. It just means it's a dimension of the act that's not being pursued at this time, as opposed to a dimension of the act that's being thwarted. We often use the example, you know, people say, well, it's the same result. Well, no, it isn't. You know, there's a difference between me supporting my family by, you know, robbing 7-Elevens and me supporting my family by working, you know, honestly. So there's a big difference between what happens in natural family planning and what happens with the use of contraception. And, of course, natural family planning can be used to get pregnant as well as to avoid pregnancy where there's a good reason to.
Right. Very well. Very well put. And on that analogy, the robbing the 7-Elevens was the wrong one, right?
That's right.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
You're writing a book on
morality.
Jesus' moral teachings, right?
That's right. Yeah. Right. The whole robbing thing. Oh, that's funny, because Jesus, St. Paul, that's funny. I was just talking with Carlo about this the other day. This is apropos of nothing now, but when Paul is listing the sins, you know, I'll have to find it. The passage where Paul is like the people who won't enter the kingdom of heaven, and it's this sin and this sin and this sin. He actually says, and nobody ever notices this, he says robbers in one point, and then he says thieves in another point. And so it's like none of the sexual sins are named twice, but stealing from people is named twice in there. So don't rob the 7-Eleven. Yeah. No. Casey in Texas, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app, you are up next. Casey, go ahead with your question for Mark.
How are you guys doing today?
Very well, Casey. Thank you.
All right. So my question is, let's say you're it's dinner time and you're eating your meal, and maybe it's a big meal, and so you don't finish all of it, but you say the blessing and everything, you say grace, and you save half of it for later. When later comes and you want to put your meal in the microwave and heat it up again, and you're about to eat it again, you have to say another blessing, or does the first blessing carry over?
Can I, Mark, answer this? Because I think I know the answer
to
this.
Go
and then
it.
You just tell me if I'm right or wrong. If you put the food in the freezer, the blessing will keep. In the refrigerator, it'll keep a couple days, but if you leave it out, it will not keep. Does that make sense, Casey?
Yes.
No, Casey, that's not really the answer. Mark, what's the actual answer? This is actually a very good question.
When we ask God to bless food, we ask Him to bless what's before us. And when we thank God for what we've consumed, we thank God for what we've consumed. So my view is that if you're eating leftovers, you're asking God to take the food that's before you and make it nourishing and for His purpose. Now, if you don't do that, or is something terrible happened, have you sinned or anything? No, but I think the general attitude is that the act of eating is what we're asking God to bless, and we do that by asking Him to bless the food that we're going to eat. So I would say that whenever we're going to consume eat a meal or something like that we should ask God's blessing on the food, even if it's the same food that we ask God's blessing on the day before. And I think likewise, when we've had a meal and we thank God for the food that we've eaten, it's not just the physical bits that have been consumed. It's the fact that God has blessed us through this food. So if we thank God for the pizza that we consumed on Tuesday night, and it's now Wednesday, and we consume pizza again, that blessed pizza again, we should thank God at the end of consuming it for the meal that we've had.
Casey?
That sounds great. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I thought my answer was more technologically precise, but I'm going
to
go with
it. It was. And, you know, if we were to look at the atomic structure of the food, we'd probably notice that what you said is true. But
I think I actually stole that answer from Jimmy Akin. I think he actually gave that answer one time before. And it amused me so much. I was so happy I got to say it again. But I got to give credit where credit is due. Or blame. Where blame is due is more likely.
That sounds like yet another awesome Jimmy Akin response.
Yeah, that's like the time a person called and said to Jimmy, you know, the people that they knew a lot of people who were renewing their marriage vows, and why are they renewing them? And Jimmy said, well, they probably wore out. Like, how old were they? That was so funny. But then you have to give the correct answer. My answer
was
not correct.
The person that doesn't hear the whole show, you know, is
yeah,
radio
that just hears
out.
That part.
That boy's like, oh, my goodness.
What if my wedding vows wear out? Connor in Shreveport, Louisiana, I promise I will not be a smart aleck about your question. Go ahead with your question for Mark Brumley.
Hi. First, I'd love to listen to a Catholic Focus about a reading list. That'd be awesome. Because since I graduated, I started doing a lot of book reading.
Wait, what'd you graduate from?
I graduated from college.
Yeah. See, this is when the real learning starts, is after you graduate. And I'm glad that you are pursuing that. Many people think that's what college is for. No, that's what college prepares you for. Good for you, Connor. Go ahead with your question for Mark.
So my question is, that's not really mine. It's from, I want to say he's agnostic, for benefit of the doubt. One of my friends, he asked, why would God make someone gay if he sends them to hell for following through with their desires? He said that's basically like giving someone wings and punishing them for using them.
Mark?
Okay. Well, first of all, the assumption is that God makes people have a same-sex attraction. I don't know that we know that. Second point, we do know that people by nature tend to have opposite sex attraction, but we can't just do whatever we want when it comes to opposite sex attraction just because we, you know, people by nature tend to have opposite sex attraction. Nor should we therefore assume that if someone has a same-sex attraction, that one is therefore free to do whatever he wants in satisfaction of that same-sex attraction. The fact is, we come into this world with lots of dispositions, inclinations to do all kinds of things. Over time, we could talk about whether or not those inclinations or tendencies are innate or whether they are acquired over time, or developmental, or develop over time. But whether they're innate or acquired over time, we have to bring to bear the use of our reason to respond to our inclinations and our attractions and all these things in a way that's consistent with the purpose that God has for us as human beings. I may feel like I have an innate inclination to eat anything that comes into my sight in any quantity I want. But that doesn't mean that that's good for me. I have to exercise my reason and say, well, what kind of things nourish me? What's actually good for me to thrive as a human being and what is not? So I can't put it on God. Why did you make me with an appetite? Or why did you make me with this inclination towards X, Y, or Z and then not let me do whatever I want to satisfy that. So with respect to same-sex attraction, we're going to say people may have same-sex attractions. But the mere fact that I have an attraction to a member of the same sex doesn't mean that I should be able to satisfy that desire by having sexual relations with that person. I need to discipline my desires and by God's grace, order my actions properly and consistent with God's purpose. And I may find I have inordinate inclinations to not just sexual inclinations, but in other areas of life as well. And it takes intelligence and discipline and the acquisition of virtue, which grace helps us to accomplish, to acquire. So we don't, it's not like giving us wings and damning us for flying. It's because we don't, number one, don't regard, first of all, we don't have wings, it's not like giving us arms and then damning us for using them. It's more like giving us arms and then damning us for using them in ways that harm other people or harm ourselves. That's what it's akin to, rather than having arms and using them in ways that are consistent with God's purpose for human beings and human fulfillment. So I just would stop. I would not accept the premise that God makes people innately have same-sex attraction. But even if we were to find that there was some kind of biological basis for same-sex attraction, as there is a biological, apparently a genetic basis for things like schizophrenia, that somehow means that people can do whatever their biologically or genetically rooted inclinations incline them to do. No, we'd say those things need to be integrated into a person's whole life so that if an inclination is contrary to the good of that person learns how to order his inclinations and to not act on them in ways that are destructive, but to utilize them in ways that are fruitful and benefit. And that can happen for people with same-sex attraction when they don't act on it, when they integrate it into a life of virtue, of chastity, and refrain from doing something even though they have a desire to do it, like as we all have to, by the way. I'm a married man. I have to refrain from, you know, sexual inclinations and desires to have relations with women who aren't my wife, and that's just part of the nature of living as human beings. It has its challenges. I'm not trying to make light of struggles that same-sex attracted people have any more than I'm trying to make light of struggles that people who have problems, heterosexual persons who have problems with chastity or fidelity in marriage or any number of things have. It's part of the human situation. God allows us to struggle through these things because he knows that through them we can become better persons and we can grow in virtue and accomplish levels of goodness and virtue and love that we'd otherwise not be able to accomplish. But that could be very challenging for people, whether they're same-sex attracted people or opposite-sex attracted people. We need to be compassionate, but we can't tell people things that aren't true.
Connor, thank you very, very much for the question. I hope that that was helpful to the person who posed that to you. I hope that that helps you answer that. We have to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Mark Brumley right after this.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Go forth and preach the good news. It's not just a suggestion. If you want to take more seriously the command of Jesus to share the gospel with those around you, consider joining St. Paul Street Evangelization. It's a grassroots organization that brings the Catholic faith to the streets in a non-confrontational way. Visit our website, www.streetevangelization.com, to learn more. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. It's time to do our part.
EWTN podcasts are the perfect companion for busy Catholics everywhere. Your favorite EWTN programs are waiting for you to listen to on your time. With on-demand access to audio, you can pause and pick up right where you left off, anytime, anywhere. Just subscribe by using your mobile device's free podcast app. Find old favorites or discover something new. EWTN podcasts, they're waiting for you.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Our guest is Mark Brumley. He's the president of Ignatius Press, the most important publisher in the Alpha Quadrant of any kind of materials at all. And he's also the author of The Seven Deadly Sins of Apologetics. Mark, it's always great when you're here. Thanks for being here. Just in case I don't get to say that at the end.
I enjoy it. You guys are great. I love Catholic Answers.
Well, you made it, so I appreciate that.
I made it? Okay.
Well, you and a small handful of others made Catholic Answers.
No, I was involved early on, and Carl did it, and then, you know, I was there for a couple years with the team, and but I, you know, continue to support Catholic Answers and pray for Catholic Answers.
So it is amazing what Carl did in founding Catholic. It is amazing. It's like Father Fessio. In founding Ignatius.
And another amazing, you know, and these things came on the scene around the same time. I mean, officially Catholic Answers started much earlier than, in fact, Carl, you know, when Carl actually had an active apostolate, and that came some years later, but yeah.
You know, I don't know if you know this, but there's a little bit of a bad mood in the Catholic community over the last couple of decades. People seem to feel like everything's fallen apart and nothing in the church works and all that. There's a little bit of that. But the number of people who have gone out and founded new Catholic institutions, a new Catholic radio station or a new Catholic university, or like you with Ignatius Press, or Carl here with Catholic Answers. It's amazing the vitality of the Catholic community that we oftentimes forget about. We don't even, I mean, Mother Angelica with EWTN. Right. It's amazing.
Absolutely. I mean, when I became a Catholic, you know, 40 years ago, it was a completely different situation. And there was a lot of discouragement, confusion. Institutionally, you know, it would not be uncommon to go to Mass and hear a priest criticize the Pope, or at least to gainsay something that the Pope said, or wouldn't be unusual for you know, all kinds of expressions of chaos and confusion in the church. That is not typical today. We have our divisions and our disagreements, but that kind of thing is not typical. And I see these apostolates and all these things as being fruit in many ways of the Second Vatican Council and the fidelity of Paul VI, and especially John Paul II with the long pontificate of John Paul II, and obviously Benedict. And, you know, Francis has come, you know, late to the game, but I see the fidelity of these men in promulgating this vision, and then, you know, the faithful responding and the Holy Spirit raising up people to do all these kinds of wonderful things. Again, we have serious problems in the church today, as we have in our world today, but you know, we're not in the situation that we were in 1968, 1978, not even 1988, which was, you know, again, time where renewal was ramping up, but there were still lots of challenges. So these are great times in many ways and great things, and we have so many resources available to us through so many great apostolates. So praise the Lord.
Yes, amen. Praise the Lord. That's why it's good to get the perspective of old men like yourself who have been through all this and know
ancient
this.
Guys.
Ed in Melbourne, Florida is next, watching on YouTube Live. Ed, go ahead with your question for Mark Brumley.
Yeah, good evening. I was hoping Mr. Brumley could help me out with 2 Samuel 24 and the census that David conducted. And it's just confusing. And, you know, he wasn't supposed to, so God punishes him and asks him to pick his punishment, essentially. But it seems at the beginning that God told him to conduct the census. So I was hoping you could help me understand that.
Well, sure. I'm going to read from the Ignatius Catholic Study Bible note on this and encourage people who want to get the volume on 1 and 2 Samuel that might be helpful. In verse 24, our introduction of chapter 24, verses 1 through 25, it says, David sins by conducting a military census. The fallout is a plague from the Lord let loose upon the people. The incident shows, among other things, that the fate of Israel rides on the shoulders of the king. When the king is prayerful and pious, the kingdom prospers. When the king is sinful and selfish, the kingdom suffers. David is eventually able to limit the devastation by acknowledging his guilt and showing repentance through sacrifice. Note 1. Note number 2. the Lord is angry because of this, and it says there's a parallel account, 1 Chronicles 21:1, which identifies Satan as the instigator of David's wrongdoing. Although worded differently, the two statements are not incompatible. The author of Samuel stresses all things, good as well as evil, necessarily take place within the parameters set by the will of God. So it is God's will in that sense of providence. Not even the spiritual forces of darkness operate outside and independently of divine providence. Whatever creatures, seen or unseen, may be permitted to act as agents of temptation, none discharges this role without the Lord allowing it to happen. So the diabolical dimension of it is David is trying to number the people. He's trying to, as rulers did in those days, in order to control the people, to dominate the people, to tax the people, to subjugate them. And he is, in that way, behaving like the kind of king that Samuel the prophet warned Israel against when they said, we want to have a king like other nations. And ultimately, God said, I'm going to do that. I'm going to give you the king like other nations. But realize that when you get that, the kings are going to do all these kinds of bad things, and you're not going to like it, and you're going to complain. And so David, in fact, is behaving that way. So from the perspective of divine providence, you know, he's acting according to the permissive will of God. But with respect to specific will and what God's purpose is for the king and the misbehavior kings sometimes engage in, he's acting contrary to God's will. So that's really why there is this difference of perspective and interpretation of the event.
Ed, I'm going to leave it there. I hope it was helpful to you. I'm trying to get as many as I can on with Mark before we end, and we are almost at the end. Nathan in Detroit, Michigan. Oh, that makes me want to see Guys and Dolls. You are up next, Nathan. You got to be quick with your question, though.
Absolutely. Just real quick, thank you for your book, Si. It's fantastic. It's a great reset for me.
Why didn't I put really you at the end that. Of the show, Nathan? We could have been talking about this whole time.
I know. I had like a 15-minute speech for you, and then you rushed me.
We'll call back tomorrow, Nathan. You'll be on first. I can guarantee it.
Okay, good. Mr. Brumley, my question is, if there were other people alive, say, during Abraham's time in different parts of the world, let's say what is now China, and I apologize for the ignorant question, but what would be their route, if you will, to salvation? Would it be similar to what the Catechism says in regards to that in our hearts that everyone knows that there really is a God and living a moral life? How would that go about for them?
Well, the answer is that everybody is saved by the grace of Jesus Christ, either in anticipation of Christ's coming or after Christ's coming. And either with explicit knowledge of Christ or with implicit knowledge or response to Christ by one's grace-enabled response to what light one has. So before Christ, you know, obviously God had established in the world an objective order of redemption, which is Jesus Christ. He's pointing to that before Christ. He's building up to that before Christ through the covenants that he initiates in the world, especially through the Mosaic Covenant. But there are people in the world who are outside of that, either outside of that knowledge of that or unaware that even if they know that there's a Moses and a Mosaic Covenant, that this is the true God. And so, at this point in Jesus Christ, but they're saved by their response to what light they have, or they're damned by what response they have to that light. So. That's what I would say.
Nathan, thank you for the kind words about my book, and thank you for the call and question. I'm sorry that we got to you so late in the program, but you're very gracious. Mark Brumley, you're gracious as well. It's always nice to spend time with you.
Well, you are as well. Amazing grace. Your name is Si. So.
Oh, wow. Wow. Thanks, Mark. We're going to do a focus episode with you. People have already called and said they want to hear that focus episode. Mark Brumley is the president of Ignatius Press. You can find them at ignatius.com. He's also the author of The Seven Deadly Sins of Apologetics. And he's a podcaster, which he's too humble to tell you about. Where can they find the podcast, Mark?
They can go Podbean or they can go to ignatius.com.
We'll see you tomorrow.
Or go to Podbean.
All right. See you tomorrow. God willing, right here. Catholic Answers Live.